Today's Teisho is on case 25 from the Book of Serenity. Case 25 is entitled Yan Wan's Rhinoceros Fan. Introduction. Oceans of lands without bound are not apart from right here. The events of infinite aeons past are all in the immediate present. Try to make him present it face to face, and he won't be able to bring it out in the wind. But tell me, where is the fault? Case, one day, Yan Wan said to his attendant, "Bring me the rhinoceros fan." The attendant said, "The fan is broken." Yan Wan said, "If the fan is broken, then bring me back the rhinoceros." The attendant had no reply. Zhifu drew a circle and wrote the word rhino inside it. Verse, as the fan is broken, he seeks the rhino. The word in the circle has a reason. Who would have known the 1,000-year light of the full moon would subtly make a pervasive, luminous spot of autumn? Again, for really wonderful sitting. People are really practicing wholeheartedly. And it's so wonderful to see, you know, people come in on the third day of Sesshin, and the change is always so noticeable. It's always, you know, pretty dramatic. Those of you who came on Tuesday night, you know, have been through a challenging period. There's no question about it. You know, day two is a really challenging day. You know, that's where we are pushed to our limits. You know, day one is challenging too. You know, but you, by the end of the day, you're getting tired. It's 9:30, and you thinking, I want to be in bed. I've had it, you know. And you get up the next day at 4:30 and get to the cushion by 5. And you know, by the end of the second day, even if you're sort of a veteran of all this, you might be thinking of, you know, just ducking out. You know, it's I was told by somebody who I had never been to the Rochester Zen Center. It's a very famous Zen Center that was founded by Philip Kaplow Roshi, one of the first real Roshis to teach in the United States. And at Kaplow's place, apparently it's outside of Rochester, New York, what they do is when you arrive, you have to turn in your car keys, so you can't flee on day two, right? Of course, that's legally questionable, right? You have a right to go if you want to go, but I don't think there's been any lawsuit. There have been any lawsuits because people who stay realize, oh, I'm so glad I didn't go, but it's certainly been the case in my experience that day two is when people make a break, you know. Many is the time we've had newcomers come to Sesshin here. And, it'll be 10 o'clock, 10:30 at night, and we'll be sitting here, and I can just hear the tires on the gravel in the driveway just, you know, skidding out, you know, fleeing. That's such a pity, right, that people do that, because, you know, you definitely, so many people here, you know, day three, it's like, there's like this magic change that happens, right, and please remember that, you know, because, every time you come to Sesshin for a long, long time, you know, it will be the case that around the end of day two, you'll be thinking, why did I do this, you know? And what I think happens is that you you begin to step out of your ordinary mental habits, your ordinary vasana. We were talking yesterday about how we're held in place by these deeply ingrained habits that are reinforced culturally, and that therefore create the world we think of as real. And so if you have a lifestyle where you get up early in the morning and stress is your constant companion, and you get on the Garden State Parkway, and you get to work, and just sort of ducking and covering at work, and so on and so on, and then you come home, and all of these things are like reinforcing these vasana, right? Reinforcing the energy habits. And people work very hard, and then they say, gee, I've worked so hard, how can I reward myself? You can take a few weeks off for vacation, but 2 weeks that's not a lot of time, right? So then you think, how can I, so then people, maybe they, decide to, buy something, right? Maybe I'll buy something. And buying something is interesting. Shopping is an interesting experience. We're hunters and gatherers. We look for new things. You find though that maybe these things you get don't have any lasting. They're exciting at first, and then it's not so exciting. Then you have to get something new. So all of this is part of reinforcing this reality we live in. And by day two, there's like this discontinuity between the vasana and this other way of life, right? This other way of life, that we call sesshin. And, this sesshin schedule is like ancient. This goes back to, really, it goes back to the Buddha's time, But it definitely goes back to like around the 5th or 6th century in China. Apparently in India, it's not certain, but it seems likely that people in India meditated individually. In some places in like Southeast Asia today, monks and nuns go off into the forest, and they stay by themselves and meditate alone. They have these little meditation huts that are called kuti, and they're, as you can imagine, they're covered with mosquito netting, right? And Tibetans too, apparently, until very recently, Tibetan practitioners practiced alone. So, you would meet with your teacher, and then you'd go sit in your room and practice meditation. But the Chinese had this idea, right, of doing this collectively. And the results are really extraordinary, right? Really extraordinary. And the whole day is structured with enlightenment in mind, right? So, we get up at 4:30, at 5 o'clock, many traditions, not only Buddhism, believe that this is like optimum. Before the sun comes up, your energies are in a particularly auspicious place for this kind of an activity, right? And so we get up, pretty much at the right time to, usually also when you get out of sleep, your mind is fresh. Your dreaming process has sorted through all the stuff from the previous day. It's like everything's been put in the right file folder, and it's sort of like cleaned up. And you get up and you come in and sit down on the zendo, and your mind's really very open, very clean already. And we're at this time of day when all of these different traditions say our energy's at a particularly advantageous place. And then we chant the sutras. And the sutras are the sutras make no sense at all to most people who chant them in East Asia. You know, you can read the Sanskrit originals, but we're reciting Japanese phonetic versions of Chinese phonetic versions of Sanskrit. For the most part, that's true. So it's not about the meaning, although you can read the meaning. It's about working with the vasana again, right? The energies. So you know, the ideal way to do the sutra recitation is to sit properly and breathe from your hara, from your dantian, and you shujo muhan. So you're vocalizing from down under your navel, right? And notice that the sutras have different pacings, right? Some are slow. You know, we do the Heart Sutra very very stately and as sort of a stately pace, and then the Dharani, which is like a magical spell, right? The Dharani. Very fast, you know, and then each of these has like a different tempo and even a different rhythm. You'll notice that there's like a backbeat in a couple of them, right? So people have worked all this out, and this is getting you ready for deep meditation, right? So we recite the sutras, we have some delicious umeboshi, and then we sit down for that glorious, glorious morning meditation. It's like nothing in the world, you know. You know, the table has been set, you know, all this stuff that's getting up at the right time, sutra recitation, which is this working with your vasana and this collective practice. You know, this is like one of the great secrets of Zen is collective practice, this collective energy. It's so powerful. And then we have this glorious morning zazen. You know, and the food, incredibly, good food, you know, and it's a healthy, vegan diet. You know, all of this is contrived to make it possible for us to experience our lives in a radically different way. You know, and at first, you know, it's a little jarring, right? We bring all these mental habits, and by day two, tired, and your legs are hurting, but I don't really think that's why people decide to leave. You know, I think they decide to leave because they can't. It's too jarring a discontinuity between their everyday lives. And this life they're living here, it's like I try to get my brother interested. I love Indian food, and I try to get my brother interested in Indian food. And my brother is the kind of person, he's deceased now, but he was the kind of person who thought of like a meal was a big piece of meat and some potatoes, right? And so I said, Peter, let's go try some Indian. I have got to introduce you to this. And it was just like, it was a nightmare for him, right? The spices alone were like so challenging. And, it was so funny. I didn't mean to put him on the spot, you know, but he just couldn't make the transition. It was just too much. So I think part of this is the shock of like coming back to, if I may say so, it's a little bit like coming back to sanity, right? You know, at least that's my speculation. But this is like medicine, right? In my opinion, and you know, this is just my opinion, I think this is the best way for humans to live. I honestly do. I think it's the best way for humans to live, right? You know, everything is here that we need to work with in order to wake up. And it's deeply healing and energizing, right? And you know, the view is that in that energy, that life energy, the vasana are like little whirlpools in a stream, right? They're like, our vasana are like little, you know, I'm sure you've seen water flowing through a stream and a stone will obstruct the flow and a little whirlpool will build up, you know. Those are our, like our vasana, right? And there's like this generalized, you could say, life energy, right? And you know, what we do is we actually spend a lot of energy blocking, a lot of time and effort blocking that energy. And it's one of the reasons I think people feel so tired a lot of the time, right? You know, it's like we're constantly keeping a lid on ourselves, right? And regulating ourselves. And you could say, well, we're regulated here, but I think the structure of the sesshin is designed to just gradually take away one barrier after another. And my feeling is that around day three, people begin to experience themselves differently, their lives differently. And of course, the meditation itself is profoundly purifying and liberating. And so, you know, the meditation alone is removing obstacles and letting the energy flow freely. You know, it's a rule of our Zendo that you're not really supposed to actually have conversations with people. And you're not really even supposed to make eye contact in Zen temples. And you know, when people come to a Zen temple, that can seem so off-putting. It's like so cold. But you know, think about how often, you know, the first thing I do before I go in to teach is I go into the bathroom and I try to look at myself in the mirror and make sure there's nothing wrong. You know. And you know, I want to make sure I look decent for my students. You know, and I don't have much hair left, but I'll try to straighten what's left of my hair or whatever. You know, and it's mostly just symbolic. I'm saying I have to get myself, I have to make myself acceptable for the people I'm going to meet. You know, and I've been doing that all my life, right? You know, and we do this all the time. You know, we're constantly checking out others, checking us, and we're trying to tailor our responses, our appearance to elicit a favorable response from others, you know. And that's tiring, actually. You know, here you can just come in and sit down. Nobody's watching you, or nobody's supposed to be watching you. And you can stop monitoring your appearance. You know, you don't have to be too conscious of what other people think of you or too worried about that. And that's actually very liberating in itself. And, you know, and actually, you know, when people are quiet, the way we're quiet, you know, they begin to notice all these things. Last night, we had this incredible, that was so amazing, right? That storm was like unbelievable. It was like the nature paid us a visit last night. You know, this the very spirit of the natural world arrived here. And it was just the awesome power, the lightning and thunder and the rain. It was just like beautiful. And imagine all the people who didn't even notice that because they were inside watching television. You know, and they might have walked by the window and thought, wow, it's really raining. Right? You know, we became one with the rain. Right? When we do sesshin here in August, it's a little hot, you know. And, you know, there is air conditioning in the dormitories now, which is great, you know. But you know, usually we don't air condition the Zendo. Because, you know, part of being in the world is being with the world. And when you're, you know, when you're hot, it's okay to be hot. You know, it's okay. And you sit on the cushion, and in August, when I sit on this cushion in these robes, you know, I have to confess I'm covered with sweat after about half an hour. And at first you think, oh, this is really icky, I'm covered with sweat, you know, and it's really hot. In Zen, there's a saying, a very famous saying, it says, when it's hot, let the heat kill you. And when it's cold, let the cold kill you. You think, oh, that sounds terrible. No, no. You know, it means, you know, when you're hot and you say, I hate this, I hate this, I hate this, you go into deep samadhi, and suddenly, you know, you feel your awareness expand beyond the perimeters of your uncomfortable body. And you feel liberated. You feel connected to everything, you know, everything. So, you know, even the heat we flee from is offering us an opportunity to wake up. And the same is true for the cold, you know. In temples in Japan and China, they didn't have central heating in the 7th century. So when it was, you know, 30 degrees outside, it's 30 degrees inside. I've practiced under those circumstances. It's so hard to overcome. It's just like to overcome that sense of cold. And I have, you know, sat there and just shaken like a leaf, right? You know, but then, you know, you go into deep samadhi and you absolutely become still. And I remember at this one sesshin, thinking around day two, I can't stand this one more minute, you know, and then on day three, something just happened. And we had to go, it was a ceremony, we had to go out into this graveyard, this Japanese graveyard, and recite sutras for the, you know, monks in generations past. And we all had to go out, and this is in upstate New York. You know. It was a Japanese Roshi's temple in the Catskills, I should say. And it was like, you know, 7 degrees out. And I was out in a robe just like this, and I just felt absolutely at ease. And it was amazing to me. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe this. But it's like you become one with what's happening. And you expand, and everything that meets you is, you know, your life. So, you know, it's common discovery in Zen, that this in Buddhism in general, you know. In Tibetan Buddhism, they have a PhD degree called a Geshe degree. And in some Tibetan Buddhist traditions, one of the exams is they give you a pile of wet shirts, and your job is to put one on at a time and dry it out with your body heat. And if you dry all the shirts, I guess you get a PhD. But it's not meant to be torture. It's meant to be this great gift, this great opportunity. So yesterday I was talking about how, you know, we tell these stories about how things are supposed to go, and then things don't go that way, right? And that basically that's the best thing that could possibly happen to us. And this koan you could think of as like a continuation of that. You know, one day, Yang Guan called his attendant and said, bring me the rhinoceros fan. So in China at one time, in the Tang Dynasty, and in modern Japan, when Roshis deliver like Teisho, they have a fan, and they actually, there's a little ritual, you open the fan up and set it on the ground, and you give your Teisho, and then you close the fan. So the Roshi, the Shifu, calls the attendant and says, please get me the rhinoceros fan, a fan with a picture of a rhinoceros on it. So the attendant runs into the, you know, into the room where these things are kept. He comes back and he says, uh-oh, the rhinoceros fan is broken. So then the teacher says, well, if you can't bring me the rhinoceros fan, then bring me the rhinoceros. See? And the attendant is stumped, doesn't know what to do. You know, so we're all a bit like that attendant when we live our lives or when we practice Zen, right? We have a story in our heads about how things are supposed to be. And it's often the case that, it's generally the case that reality does not follow those instructions, right? So, you know, I said yesterday I used to come to Sesshin thinking this will happen at Sesshin. I will have this amazing experience and I will have, be totally transformed. I've told this story before, probably many times before, but a friend of mine was training, I guess it was in California, it might have been in Japan, but he was in a Zen temple and he was sitting there and all of a sudden the ground moved under his feet and he thought, this is it, I'm having Daikensho. And he looked around and the Zendo was empty, everybody had fled, it was an earthquake. So, you know, we have a picture of how things are supposed to go, but, you know, things don't go that way. And then what? See, then what? And this is, it's often the case with koan training that people are looking for the stories they know to guide them. So the way a koan works is a koan is like you could think of as an unconscious cue. So these Zen masters who were sort of geniuses wrote these amazing little narratives, these little vignettes. And when we sit with the vignette, we can read it and it makes some kind of interpretive sense. But that's really not the function. That you could think of the koan as being like an unconscious cue or like a... it's like there's usually like a mantra, you could say. So every koan has a turning phrase or a turning word, and that's what you internalize after reading the koan. And you're supposed to go into deep mushin, and then instead of calling mu, you recite the turning phrase. So in this case, it would be rhinoceros. In other koans, it might be give, take, or original face. And you're not supposed to think the koans through. You're supposed to go down, you go into deep samadhi, and that means that you become one with the object of your attention. Samadhi means you're becoming one with the object of your attention. And you'll notice that when you're in samadhi, you often stop self-referencing. Right? You often stop thinking of yourself as the center of your experience. You're just experiencing. And self-referencing, or the self, becomes a presence in your experience only intermittently. And this happens to people when they're riding their bikes, it happens to people when they're jogging. But it's very significant that, you know, consciousness continues after we stop imagining ourselves or referencing ourselves. You know, yourself is not the source of your thinking, it is a thought. Yourself is not the source of your thinking, it's produced by your thinking. And it's a temporary thought that comes and goes. So when you enter samadhi, you're beginning to enter this altered state of consciousness, and then you need to be able to go into a particular kind of samadhi. There are actually, there's like 100, there are really countless samadhis. You know, if you're a smoker, there's a smoking samadhi where you become one with smoking. It's very pleasant, right? But very bad for you. You know, people drink because there's drinking samadhi. You know, you can, a bicycle samadhi or hiking. I love hiking samadhi, right? You forget about everything. You're just in the moment. You stop self-referencing. So we do a kind of samadhi which is the samadhi of emptiness. So the object of our attention is not, you know, the mountains or the bicycle or the cigarette, it's emptiness, that blank space at the end of your breath. You fuse yourself with that and you get very adept at going to that empty place. And then you recite the turning phrase, rhinoceros, rhinoceros. See, and you know, the story that the koan tells is a story, you know. But actually, you can't, it really doesn't give you any way to resolve it. You know, it's like a puzzle that can't be resolved intellectually. So you have to call on other, you could say, cognitive faculties that you have. So you have to draw on other forms of intelligence that we modern people don't use very much. You know, the ancient Buddhist, the first Buddhists were called shramanera, like shaman. You know, this is like a pre-modern, actually agricultural age mode of consciousness. It's not idea dependent. You know, it's not linear, but it's real. It's deeply human way of knowing. But these are the newfangled ways of knowing, thinking, and so on. They're very limited. You know, this is like ancient way of knowing. So, you know, we go into this blank mind and we internalize the turning phrase. And this deeper intelligence that we have is activated and helps us to, it takes us on a journey. So people in the non-informed world think of Zen koans as puzzles that are to be answered. But koans take us on a journey. It's like a raven flies into your room and says, come with me, right? Or a magical animal, right? And you follow it, and it takes you somewhere that you don't know. You know, it's not made obvious to you by the stories you want to tell. When people come into Dokusan, you know, they don't always know. Sometimes they do, but they don't always know what's happening. You know, especially typically beginners don't. So you know, I'll give them a koan that's what's the sound of one hand clapping? And people will come in and say, no sound, you know, so on. These are ideas, right? And they haven't let the koan guide them. And, you know, they're waiting for a quote-unquote Zen experience. They're waiting for the earth to move or something. And they might come into Dokusan and I'll say, what's happening with your koan? And people will say, nothing. I say nothing. Well, what are you doing all day on the cushion? And they'll say, oh, nothing. I say, well, come on, tell me, you know. They'll say, well, I keep thinking about my father. But that has nothing to do with the koan, see. It's a koan about, you know, a sound of one hand clapping. But what they don't realize is that the big mind is actually saying, hey, this is something you need to confront. Hey, this is something you need to work through. This is actually like the path you have to take to go on this journey. This journey is taking you to your father again, and now you have to go, you have to meet him again and resolve something that is unresolved. And now, you know, we thought of this as like a spiritual practice that would involve, you know, I don't know if you are a fan of the Doctor Strange movies, you know, or the comic books, which I grew up on, right? But, you know, he has an amulet around his neck, he can make a circle with his hand and step through it and he's in another place, like he's in New York, and then he steps in and he's in London and so on. Well, that's maybe what we're kind of expecting, right? You know, so mystical experiences, so-called, right? You know, but actually the most profound experiences are these experiences of returning to our obstacles and dissolving them or working them through. Usually by embracing them in some way. So you know, we keep trying to experience in terms of stories we know, right? But we have to be willing to be lost in this process. And you know, and we have to be willing to work with what's presented to us by the big mind. You know, it's like if you can't find the rhinoceros fan, then work with the rhinoceros, you see. I mean, the fan is just an idea of a rhinoceros, right? You have an idea. So the rhinoceros fan is like our ideas, our stories about the world. But you know, we're so interested in conforming or in confirming our stories about the world that you know, we don't see the world itself. We can't see the world itself. You know, I often talk about the fact that I always give as an example of a problem, you know, parents who love one child more than another. And it's definitely the case you know, my parents love my brother more than they love me. I'm not gonna burst into tears or something, but you know, it was like when I would, my parents just doted on my brother, and he was a great kid, so I'm not mad at him, right? My brother was like super smart and athletic and very handsome. In fact, his son is looks like him, and you know, his son is just this very, he's a really handsome guy. And my parents loved Peter because he was outgoing, he was an extrovert, and he liked sports, he ran, you know, I was on the swimming team, and I did run track, but my brother was like a good athlete, you know, and he was charming, you know. So you know, my parents would say, oh, we love both of you equally, you know, and they do, they did love me too, of course. But I, you know, years later, I was sitting on the cushion, and I was working with this koan, and I realized, you know, my parents really lavished a kind of affection on my brother that they didn't lavish on me. You know, it's just a fact, you know. And when I realized that, you know, it made me sad, right? It was like, geez, you know, that was, but then I realized, you know, it's okay. You know, I mean, that's a human thing. They didn't choose, they just, when they saw my brother coming, they were like smiling inside, right? And I was like holed up in my room reading comic books, and you know, I was always in trouble, you know, I was that kind of a kid, you know. I got arrested once for stealing cigarettes from the store, you know. My brother was, you know, like on the honor, eventually I became a good student, you know. But the point is, you know, I didn't want to deal with this, you know. And you know, when I realized this, you know, it really had a transformative effect on my relationship with my parents and with my brother. Because I loved them more, actually, after coming to terms with this. It was like, okay, it's okay, you know, I'm okay with this. I see why you like Peter. He's a great kid, you know. And I love my parents, you know, even though they were not always even-handed. Because they were human, right? And I couldn't forgive them on some level until I confronted this, right? And you can say, well, what does this have to do with Zen? It has everything to do with Zen, right? What does this have to do with enlightenment? Everything to do with enlightenment. So, you know, I was looking for the rhinoceros fan, but the rhinoceros was, you know, my relationship, and my relationship with my brother had been troubled for reasons I didn't understand, you know. My brother was like athletic, he was a hunter, my father liked to hunt, you know, I don't hunt, you know. And, you know, I thought the reason I didn't always get along with my brother was that we were, you know, different, you know. But really the difference wasn't the issue, right? I guess I had harbored somewhere kind of feeling of injury. And when I worked this through, when I saw this and, you know, realized this, you know, it just really made it so much, I didn't go hunting with my brother, but I definitely enjoyed his company a lot more. One day, Yang Shan called to his attendant. He said, bring me the rhinoceros fans. See, this poor Inji-san, this poor attendant, he runs in and he says, oh my god, shit, the fan is broken. Right? So he comes out and he says, oh, the fan is broken. Now Sean says, great, that's the best thing. When the fan is broken, that's the best thing. When the story falls apart, that's the best thing. So now let's bring me the world. Bring me the world. You know, just a quick side, my teacher, Genki Roshi, gave me a tea bowl that he made for me personally, and I dropped it, and I broke it. You know, it just, I didn't mean to. And I was, you know, I was supposed to bring that to the Zendo in our Zen center, when the sitting period resumed. It was during a break in the sitting, the Ango, the season. And I didn't have the tea bowl. And Genki said, where's the tea bowl? And I said, oh, I left it at home. And I kept excuses. And I kept trying to find somebody. I would take this to some ceramic brand. He said, there's no way to fix this. You know, forget it. And I go, could you imitate it? Could you do a duplicate? You know, and no, this, you know. So, you know, it was so hard for me to go and say I broke the bowl, right? I remember reading about another Zen teacher, Maizumi Roshi, in Los Angeles. And one time Maizumi Roshi said, the broken bowl is the best bowl. The broken bowl is the best bowl. You know? And I didn't get it at the time. But yes, the broken bowl is the best bowl. The broken fan is the best fan. One day, Yang Guan called his attendant, bring me the rhinoceros fan. The attendant said, the fan is broken. Yang Guan said, if the fan is broken, then bring me the rhinoceros. Your life. The attendant had no reply. Zhifu, this is another master, drew a circle and wrote the word rhino inside it. See, that circle. That's the circle of emptiness, right? That's the circle. We pass through the gateless gate of emptiness to encounter the world. And as we pass through the gateless gate, our illusions, our fears and attachments drop away, and we can see on the other side the world as it is.